This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. We're here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby. And last week we were talking about the Ellsworth Kelly video that we played on video night, and it led to all kinds of interesting considerations. And I can extract a great deal from my experience of that video and his work and the responses I've had around me to his work. But you had an angle you wanted to continue.
Well, actually, there were a lot of angles that came up in our last discussion that it'd be fun to branch off in. But I had also been thinking while we were having that discussion and just in my own life lately, this principle of simplification that we started out the last show with, where it's the nature of the three of us, I know, and probably definitely many other people, to have difficulty in our own regular lives simplifying our actions. You know, actions themselves, our daily routines and the things that we do tend to just multiply, get out of hand, and we can get overwhelmed and fried and all of that. So that was what I kind of wanted to do today, was take some of these principles we were relating to his work in art to all of life. You know, why is it that difficult to allow ourselves to live a simpler life without always getting moving in the direction of more and more complexity?
Well, at the risk of repeating myself from last week, I think part of it has to do with the fact that it's easier to make things complicated. Mm. And that's born of the fact that complexity can be, and perhaps usually is, a representation of disorderliness, of chaos. Mm. So trying to simplify our lives is another way of saying trying to find the, you know, center of our lives.
Because to simplify, what we have to do is put some attention on prioritizing and really asking ourselves the question, what actually is important to me?
Yeah.
And we're too busy to do that, basically.
Well, and we have difficulty perceiving it. Yeah. In my case, I look inside and say, what do I really want? That I don't know what I really want. I think if I knew, I would just go for it. Mm. But it seems like my personality moves through modes in the course of the day, and it'll get into a mode where its priorities are one set of things, and then later in the day it'll be in a different mode, and there seems to be a whole different set of priorities that goes with that. And so you have this inconsistency in terms of what you really want. In other words, the answer to that question varies throughout the day.
Yeah, that's true, because if you start, I mean, from the way my life works, I can get very, very focused deeply on just about anything that I'm putting my attention on. So if I didn't consciously create some sort of a schedule in the day, whatever I started doing first thing in the morning, I would be doing that all day long, because right. It would endlessly take me to another stage of that one thing. So for me, and the choices of what you really want can be difficult if what you really want is everything.
Yes.
And then, you know, it's really difficult to trim it down.
Well, you could, like, start at a point, very simple point, and go to make a line, and then a square, and then, you know, and it starts to develop. And that idea and that point could expand and become your entire universe. Only that activity seems to bump into another one, which is either another idea that you generate or another person. Mm. So it starts to get very complicated very fast.
Yeah. Well, you know, it basically comes down to this thing of, if you try to simplify something, then you're consciously, you know, launching a quest for its essence. And whether you're trying to simplify an operating system, which is crashing all the time because it's got 50,000 leftover settings from when it was doing something quite different 20 years ago, or you're trying to get your priorities straight for deciding what to do this afternoon, it still involves trying to look beneath the surface and get into the essence of something. And, you know, that seems to be what we're here for. And when we're not doing that, we are inevitably making things more complicated instead.
This thing of simplification, doesn't it seem to equate somewhat with the life principle that keeps renewing life against the entropy principle it wants to
sure.
keep? What we're describing.
There's the irony, you know, because life drinks orderliness from the environment, as Desjardins said, I think, I forget who it was. But life drinks orderliness from the environment. We take organized stuff in as food, and disorganized stuff is, you know, removed. And in the process, we become more sophisticated. We become more highly structured. But at the same time, that greater degree of structure has a greater degree of complexity. So ordered complexity is being balanced against chaos, and the chaos is actually increasing as a result of the presence of life, but it's increasing on the other side of this membrane, you know, with life on one side and entropy on the other.
So that's why when we were watching at the Odd Thursday, focusing on Paul Klee's dialogue with nature, that's why watching those images gave people such bliss, because he was doing exactly that. He was taking all of these complex organisms in nature, searching for the essence, but showing in the works of art both the simplicity and the complexity and how they interact with each other in the process of growth and dispersal and all of the other things that he portrayed. And I think that just physically, in watching those images, it just made everybody feel nourished, because his focus was such a long-term focus on that problem in life, that principle in life, that he really gained mastery in expressing that in these simple, almost cartoon-like forms. And because of pretty much all of the Odd Thursdays we've done, I think there were more people who came up afterwards from that one and said, I just feel so good after mm-hmm. watching those slides. And even people who didn't know
students came from that experience and wanted to do that thing. They wanted to be able to do that themselves in the studio.
Because it's so fundamental. I mean, what you just described, mm-hmm. Alan, indicates how that's so fundamental to life, to want to do that mm-hmm. and live life that way. It's great.
And that's why cartoons themselves are so powerful, you know.
Well, they leave off, you know,
just leave out all
disturbing
the
things like genitals. And
they deal with just the essence of a situation. They've boiled something down to its absurdity, mm-hmm. and it's a relief, you know, to see that the horrendous complexities of social interaction are fundamentally irrelevant. And when we see the irrelevance, it makes us laugh. And I think part of that is with relief, mm-hmm. to see that, God, I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
All right. So this will shift things a little bit. Why did people have such a hard time with the simplification that Ellsworth Kelly presented to them? I mean, it disturbed people. It upset some people. Mm-hmm. They just couldn't deal with it. Because you'd think that bringing things down to a minimalist, because, I mean, he represents the minimalist movement. I found such satisfaction, personally, in the emergence of the minimalist movement. To see a Tony Smith cube sitting there is such a complete experience of and aha and relief and like yes. Why is that so disturbing? Do they need complexity?
Well, possibly. I mean, we kind of assume that everybody else's inner worlds are similar to our own, but they may not be. I mean, it always astonishes me when anybody says, who is not, you know, an invalid or something like that, says, "I'm bored." I can't imagine in this world of so many possibilities how anybody can be bored. And yet there are a lot of people who actually are and who don't know what to do with themselves if they have free time. So I think part of it may be that one of the people after the Ellsworth Kelly film who didn't like those images said, who didn't like those images said they lacked richness. That was her description, was in her observation, they lacked richness. So for her, a flat form with hard edges didn't have any of that stuff of life that maybe flowers have or whatever it was that she, you know, some incredible feast has, or a painting from the Renaissance.
For some people to appreciate, you know, minimalism and Ellsworth Kelly's kind of stripping things down, you have to be willing to toss out your volumes of clever intellectualizing. You have to be able to do without that. And I would wonder if the people who are upset by seeing something like that, I mean, really what they're upset by is not seeing it. It's by the assertion that there's some value in something that's so devoid of content or complexity. And I would wonder, are these the same people who look at a blank canvas and see a blank canvas? Whereas many of us look at a blank canvas and think, my God, that's impossible. There could be anything there. This is the field of all possibilities. I don't even know where to begin. How utterly, you know, almost horrifyingly great is this emptiness. And it's, how can you improve on it, for one thing? But being able to have that experience, I think, recognizes that, you know, you're not really... you're not really looking at a cube sitting all by itself. You're looking at how that cube is also everything but the cube is implied.
So that's a good point, because in the Ellsworth Kelly images, that's what I saw in looking, and the people who like his work, I think, see when he extracts those simple lines of shadows that a fence has cast on the sidewalk, and he, you know, you're looking at this gallery wall and you see these black lines on a white canvas. The people who appreciate that, I think, are able to see past those black lines into that whole world of pattern in nature, the whole world of magic when you're, you know, of shadow and light and structure and everything else. It's all implied in that, and it all kind of comes alive when you look at those works.
Yeah, I think it was Heidegger who said that the experience of dread is our first opportunity to, for many anyway, our first opportunity to experience infinity, because dread is fear of the loss of everything. And this is the first chance we've had to really handle the concept of everything. We don't go out in the world and think about everything, but when you think you might be dead in a minute, or somehow mentally in total limbo in a minute, it's that everything that you're afraid of losing that gets your full attention. And although it's in a negative context, you know, it's probably, you know, it's a kind of transcendental experience, and it suddenly takes you outside of the stuff and leaves you with nothing but the self. And so this, you know, the minimalist artwork is kind of saying that same thing.
Exactly.
So behold eternity, you know.
Interesting.
It brings up my first marriage. I came to terms with this. You know, I won't go so far as to say it's a male and female thing, because we're discussing it and you're male. But my wife was a romantic. Mm. And I was a minimalist, essentially. I was interested in boiling down to essentials, like ending up standing, looking at the blank wall was my idea of bliss. Only she there was dread for her in that, because the romantic world that she lived in, she's the one that painted the fairies and angels, but she didn't like to paint the space around the fairies and angels, and so I started doing a dynamic space around the little characters that she liked. And that became actually a popular art that we did. So I came to terms with that at the time, and now I'm having to come to terms with this idea again, that there's sort of like two angles on this thing, the people that are living in the story and the people that like to see the space in which the story is taking place. And it's sort of a dynamic that drives the universe, I think.
Well, and you can have both, because I loved the simplicity of Ellsworth Kelly and the other minimalist works. However, my own art is not the slightest bit minimalist. When I'm actually creating a painting, it's what I'm interested in portraying are the layers and the relationships. And there is the simplicity is in the rhythm that you can see in the midst of all of the details and the complexity. So I think there can be a mix of both of those things, or a balance of both of those things.
Well, I think wholeness requires acknowledging the pulsing of both on each other.
Sure. Well,
eternally.
And that's the experience of, you know, doing a painting or writing a poem or a story. You start looking at the blank canvas or the blank page, and then you put something on it, and you get into utter, you know, specificity. But then you have to keep going back to the blankness that surrounds the specificity you just added. And that's that sort of oscillation between the two worlds that gradually converges into some kind of artistic statement or expression. I don't even want to call it a statement, because that's that's content and it's categorizable. I mean, part of the quest, in a sense, for the essence is to find the essence of the quest. And the essence of the quest is what? It's the life force. It's consciousness sort of open, waiting. You know, it's an eyeball with, you know, nothing or everything in front of it. It's the eyeball that surrounds the universe instead of looks at the universe.
Yeah, because anytime you think that choice is an either-or situation, you're in trouble, because it never, you know, it can only, choice is, it has to be a both and, you know, everything together kind of thing, or your choices are going to, you know, lead you down a rabbit hole or in some kind of a little dead-end trap. So that's the tricky thing about the human situation, and also being an artist, is that you always have to make choices, but you don't want those choices to go in the direction of limitation. You want the choices to go in the direction of expansion, which is essentially also simplification.
Well, this gets to what we were saying about the two definitions of intellect. Mm-hmm. The one definition of intellect is it's simply the faculty which decides, and at the subtlest level of thinking, any thought that comes up, you know, it's either entertain it or not, either be interested or not. But intellect also means verbal analytical skills and people blabbing on and on like I'm doing right now. And when you're making these choices in creating a work of art, each choice activates the intellect, opens the gateway for getting completely bogged down in mentation about it. But if you're lucky or skilled or, you know, highly evolved or a really good artist or whatever, you move from that right back into the simplicity of it. You just use the intellect for making the choice. You don't need the intellect to then go explaining how beautiful a choice it was and how clever it was to have come up with that choice and so on, which is really not intellect in the higher sense. It's just the blabbing capacity. which of course I have very great reverence for.
So how much time do we have to fill with blabbering here?
We've got seven and a half minutes of blabbering.
Oh boy. I think we finished this one off.
Yeah, so where can we go for the next 7.5 minutes?
I think we could hum.
We could.
We could all...
chant something. We could... I've always said if this were a video show instead of a radio show, we could do profound things by just cutting to a blank white screen. But you can't do that with radio because the people will all think the station's gone dead and they'll go looking for another program.
So let's go back then to the Ellsworth Kelly film, because as we said earlier, there are many different directions we could go with that. And I think one of the things that I loved about what he did and what many artists have done in that era was to look at something that most people would consider to be ordinary and to find something profound in it. It's, you know, it's like a little variation on what we've been talking about, but he didn't just reduce something to its simplest essence and form, but he also, in his photographs, I thought it was interesting that in the film they didn't just include his paintings and sculptures, but also his photographs as a work of art. And his photographs were invariably about an ordinary desk or an ordinary doorway. And many other people have also photographed ordinary things like that and turned them into a thing of beauty. But when you do that, when you're isolating something in a whole field of, you know, all around you, you're able to see all of these relationships in this little frame that you're in your picture, and how that is a little gem of beauty with all of its layers and details and tones and everything else.
Yeah. Framing is really exciting. I remember in college when I happened to come into possession of a Zeiss Contarex camera with a Zeiss Icon planar normal lens on it. And the view through that 35mm camera was shocking. It was just so bright and clear that it took all your attention. It was a great big, you know, optical image and a very bright, very fine lens. And I remember the first few weeks that I had it, I couldn't stop just looking at things through the lens. Mm. I couldn't afford to burn up that much film, but it was an amazing experience. Things that you look at them through the camera and they become something else. And somehow that experience of abstracting the everyday experience that we know the whole time, this is what I was looking at a minute ago, but if I look at just that in the frame, it takes on a different power. Mm-hmm. And it's comparable to what we've talked about a million times about putting the thing on the gallery wall. You know, we're exalting it by looking at it through the camera, not as much as we are by hanging it on the wall in the gallery and bowing down to it and charging admission and things, but we try not to bow down to things in our gallery and we don't charge admission. So that's something.
But we frame it.
But we do frame it,
and it's seen in a new light.
Yeah, we do exalt it.
Well, and that's also probably why when you see photographs, like beautiful photographs of some foreign country you've never been to, you have a certain image of what that place is like. India is a classic example, because India is a very photogenic country. And, you know, there are countless books with gorgeous photographs of India. But when you actually go there and you see everything that's all, you know, and you have all the senses and not just the visual sense operating, it's extraordinarily overwhelming, because there's so much, it's so different from those beautiful little gems that you've taken in these photographs.
Yeah.
What I really appreciated from that film was, and this was the art of the filmmaker, which I think you mentioned in the last show, how I was able to become Ellsworth Kelly. I was able to see things as he saw them. And I didn't realize until I saw that film when I previewed it, how directly he pulled from things he saw around him to create the shapes he created. I didn't know that. So suddenly I had a new way of seeing things.
Well, and like, you know how they rounded out in the end, at the beginning of the movie they had these interesting shapes, you know, the four of them on the wall, and then at the very end it showed the smashed cup that had been like the spur for that shape. It was like a smashed cup that someone had stepped on the ground, and that's what sparked in him this awe for that particular shape and the mileage that he got out of that smashed cup, and the fact that he kept the smashed cup itself and put it in a frame, I thought was marvelous, because it made it into a thing of beauty when you saw the whole sequence of what that smashed cup gave birth to. And how many of us in our daily activities see things like that on the ground or anywhere and don't do that? You know, they don't spark anything. We just pick it up and throw it in the trash. And yet, you know, anything can be a spark for massive creativity.
Well, the film was just very good at communicating the concept of the artistic eye. I thought it showed how an artist's mind and eye and brain work, and it was marvelous, I thought.
There's some woman in New York, I read about on the internet, stumbled upon one time, who collected things that most people threw away because she felt like somebody needed to love these things.
Right, and who
did
was
you remember
that?
I can't remember her name.
That's a...
And she had all these like journals and various collections of these things, and she really didn't try to promote this or tell anybody about it, and I think she died or something, and they discovered this wonderful, reverent collection of stuff in her apartment that then became a popular internet site talking about this and having photographs of these things.
Speaking of complexity and chaos. Well, I think we'll thank everyone for listening.
Yeah, thank you. We've gone on quite a little complex journey in investigating simplicity.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.